From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, writing songs for Broadway, we talk with composer Charles Strauss. His musicals include Bye Bye Birdie, Applause, Golden Boy, Annie, and now the sequel, Annie Warbucks. Also from Broadway, Nathan Lane. He played Nathan Detroit in the revival of Guys and Dolls. Now he's starring in Neil Simon's new Broadway comedy. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews French Lessons, the new intellectual memoir by Alice Kaplan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. President Clinton brought his health care reform team together at the White House today to discuss strategy on getting his proposals approved. Mr. Clinton says Congress will pass a reform package this year.
This will be a year when we attempt to fix what's broken with our health care system, to keep what's right, to emphasize the program that we outlined of guaranteed private insurance for every American. Comprehensive benefits that can never be taken away, and a system that gives people who presently don't have insurance and small businesses greater power to choose affordable, quality health insurance.
The president says he expects to compromise on health care reform with his opponents. Mr. Clinton says there is a lot of room for working out the details. He says he hopes the final package will be a bipartisan achievement. The U.S. is sending a team to observe the rebellion in southern Mexico and to make sure that Americans in the area are safe. State Department spokesman Michael McCurry says all Americans who wanted to leave have done so, and those who stayed in the region are still safe. So far, the U.S. has not issued a warning for American travelers to avoid the area, as it often does in cases of local insurrection. The Palestine Liberation Organization says it won't accept Israeli conditions for resuming talks on limited Palestinian autonomy. Israel says the talks should resume on the basis of a disputed document. Alfred Hermida reports from Tunis, where the PLO is headquartered.
The talks on self-rule for the Gaza Strip and Jericho in the West Bank were meant to resume today, but they've been delayed because of an argument between Israel and the PLO over the results of the previous session of talks. Israel says the two sides agreed on a compromise document at last week's talks in Cairo, covering the question of border crossings and the size of the Jericho enclave. It wants the new discussions to be based on this alleged agreement. But the PLO denies it ever gave its backing to the document, which it says was only a draft proposal reflecting the Israeli point of view. It has rejected Israel's conditions for a resumption of the talks, describing them as unacceptable. The PLO has accused Israel of deliberately delaying the talks by changing its interpretation of the self-rule accord. For National Public Radio, this is Alf Hermida in Tunis.
Palestinian activists from the occupied territories say they have met with PLO chairman Yasser Arafat to urge him not to make all the decisions for the organization. One of the reformers says the delegation proposed wider participation in policy making. He says Arafat was willing to listen and argue, but made no promises. The reformers have opposed Arafat's independence in negotiating self-rule and his appointment of longtime PLO bureaucrats in Tunis to top jobs in governing the territory. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down a half a point in heavy trading. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. An index devised by corporate buyers predicts the economy will continue its gradual improvement. The National Association of Purchasing Management says its index for December rose more than 2 points to 57.9%. The group says a reading of more than 50% means the economy is generally expanding. Detroit's new mayor, former Michigan Supreme Court Justice Dennis Archer, took the oath of office today. Jerome Vaughn of member station WDET has the story.
Archer is Detroit's first new mayor in 20 years. He follows Coleman Young, Detroit's first black mayor, into the office. While Young was known for his complete control of city government, Archer says Detroit is headed for changes, a more open and business-friendly city. In his inauguration speech, Archer told area residents that they must take an active role in reviving the city.
Stand with me when I tell the dope man, leave our children alone! Get out of our way! taking back our children, and we're taking back our streets.
As Archer takes office, he inherits a city with a need for more police officers, a budget deficit estimated at $88 million, and a national image problem based on the city's high crime rate. For National Public Radio, this is Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
German authorities say two neo-Nazis accused of beating an American luge racer will go to trial on January 17th. The two defendants allegedly led a group of skinheads who shouted racial slurs at a black member of the U.S. luge team in a bar in Oberhof. They are charged with beating another American who came to his teammate's defense. That American was not seriously injured. The October attack was the first on an American since a wave of neo-Nazi violence began to sweep Germany 3 years ago. I'm Barbara Campbell. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I'm sure you know some of the songs written by my guest Charles Strauss. Put on a Happy Face, I've Got a Lot of Living to Do, and Kids are just some of the songs from his very first Broadway show, Bye Bye Birdie. He also wrote the music for the show's Golden Boy, Applause, and the mega-hit Annie. Before his Broadway career, he studied classical music with Aaron Copland and Nadia Boulanger. Now Strauss and lyricist Martin Charnin have written a sequel to their hit Annie called Annie Warbucks. It's playing in Manhattan off-Broadway. Before we meet Charles Strauss, let's hear Catherine Zaremba as Annie from the new CD, Annie Warbucks.
Every other Christmas, I got nothing. But this Christmas, 1933, I got everything. Even a new name. I'm Annie Warbucks. Trouble kept banging at my door. Beat it, trouble.
This music from Annie Warbucks, Charles Strauss's latest musical. Charles Strauss, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
When was the idea for a sequel to Annie generated?
Oh, it seems like early in the last century.
Right.
Actually, the lyricist and director, Martin Charnin, he had that idea, as he did the first idea, to do Annie, which was not a good idea. But
Wait. It was not a good idea?
Well, I didn't think it was a good idea, but, it's interesting what Broadway will buy. And the second idea, doing a sequel, actually came inadvertently from Columbia Pictures, because they planned and had even written the script for and hired Martin and me to do some songs for Annie 2, which then, because of an actor strike and because of some financial complications, did not come to pass. We were left with a couple of songs, and Martin thought we ought to do Annie 2 on the live stage, which we did. It was a very eagerly financed show, and it failed in Washington, D.C., but we worked on it for 5 weeks, and at the end of 5 weeks, enough important people thought there was something very good there. And the producers stayed loyal to us, and we proceeded to work on it, first in Goodspeed, and then later the Theater Alliance took it on a tour. And all the time, we never left her alone and kept polishing her. And it opened finally in New York after a great many financial aggravations and a kind of notorious publicity, considering it's such a really lighthearted optimistic kind of show.
Were you shocked when the show flopped in Washington, or did you think it had problems?
I was shocked. Now it all seems relatively simple in hindsight about one of the things that was wrong with it, and it's a rather large thing, and I think that was that we inadvertently mocked it. Annie was our dog and little kid show, and we were delighted with the success it had enjoyed. Although it's a very witty script of Tom Meehan's, it was still looked at as something that was a kind of sentimental piece, and the world took it to its heart. But we thought, oh, now we're really smart, and we're going to do a kind of mocking version of it. And that's what we did, but we didn't realize we did. But the little children in the audience told us that we did, and the critics. And they didn't say that, but they would not accept it on that level, although it was actually, I thought, a wonderful script of Tom's. And we saw very soon then that the mistake was a rather large but simple one in one sense, and that was to do it with more sincerity.
When you wrote the songs for Annie and now for Annie Warbucks, did you have to write in a range that you were confident a kid could sing?
Well, that's really an interesting question, because yes and no. The yes is a part of my musical background. I know what kids' ranges and sopranos and tenors are. The no part is that I wanted to squeeze a little bit more out of them, because the emotional part of the music is when kids sing high, they scream. You know, I did it in Bye Bye Birdie, and in Bye Bye Birdie they sang notes in the telephone hour that they didn't think they could sing. And actually, I had learned a lot of that. I used to work for Frank Lesser. I was his assistant for 2 years. And I remember when Frank was testing people for range, he would often have them sing
from Bushel and a Peck.
From Bushel and a Peck. And because it was, he would put it in a key with the pianist that it would be out of their range. They had to go But because they were making fun, they could or could not hit it. Had you said, sing that note legitimately in a song like, I don't know, If I Loved You or something, they would have said they can't reach it. But when they were playing these characters, they could. So I devised, it's not my own invention, but or maybe it is, I don't know, these kids would come in and I would just have them sing Happy Birthday. Once they passed the other thing, I would have them sing a song that they didn't have to worry about anything. And so they would, Happy Birthday, Happy Birthday. See, and very often they found that they could reach notes which on their resumes they couldn't reach at all. And that was the sound I wanted. So I did write for that, and particularly in a song like Hard Knock Life and in Tomorrow, the song Tomorrow. And what happened was that at the very beginning, during our auditions, nobody could sing these songs. Today, every girl in the world sings them, which is it's a wonderful, actually, tribute to the psychology and any popularity the songs have.
Let me move to the first show that you did that was a real hit, one of the Broadway classics, and that's Bye Bye Birdie. Now, I had to tell you, I was listening to the album again last night, and I hadn't heard the score in a long time. And I was just shocked to realize that I remembered words to songs when I'd completely forgotten the song existed, like Normal American Boy. I mean, I haven't thought about that song in years, and I realized, God, I know all the words to this. And I bet so many people have that reaction when they hear songs from Bye Bye Birdie.
Yes, fortunately they do. It's a very, very much performed show. At the time, Lee Adams and Mike Stewart and I wrote it. We wrote it because it was offered us, you might say. We would have written, I guess, almost any show that was offered us. It actually wasn't even in that shape. It was just to be a show about teenagers. But had we realized that it would have that kind of commercial clout, that is, that high schools and camps and prisons, I don't know, everybody does it. It's incredible. And it keeps picking up in performances. I think we would have said, oh, let's do that show. But at the time, it was just, it was actually even a little strange. It was a bit of an embarrassment in a funny way to me and to Mike, because, well, to me particularly, because I had I'd been in serious music all my life. I'd studied classical music. I was embarking on a serious music career, that this would be the first opportunity that I'd have for a major public hearing. And then that we had this silly name, Bye Bye Birdie, it was not the show that I wanted to write, which taught me something about myself, which is I don't know where the hell I am half the time.
Let me ask you about writing the telephone hour from Bye Bye Birdie. And this is a series of phone conversations that the teenagers are having with each other. And it's not a straightforward song. I mean, you're basically setting a series of conversations to music with little interruptions and phones right. ringing. So what were some of your considerations when you were writing the music for that?
Well, you know, before I just answer that, I have four kids, and it's come back to haunt me because I have four telephone lines, and it's still every second everybody's on the phone. Anyway, beside the point, my considerations were, first of all, that it was rock, and of its sort, it is rock music, though such an innocent sort that, you know, I don't like to listen to it and say I'm Mick Jagger or anybody like that. But it was rock, and I paid attention very strongly to the guitar chords, you know, that all guitarists play on it. You know, a lot of rock music in those days particularly was very, I don't want to say simple because that wouldn't, that would be a little bit derogatory, but there were certain patterns. It became patterned in a way, and I did model it on that. But then I used a lot of... I used a lot of changes of time and a lot of interjections, which is into the exact rock beat. But I kept the beat going very much, and then I used Lee and I sat and kind of carved it out together, high, and you know the things. Did they really get pinned?
Well, here's the telephone hour from Bye Bye Birdie, music by my guest Charles Strauss.
Hi, Margie.
Harvey Johnson, can I speak to Penelope Ann?
To about Kim.
Penelope?
I just knew it somehow.
About the prom?
I must call her right up.
Saturday?
I can't talk to you now.
Music from Bye Bye Birdie. My guest is composer Charles Strauss. He wrote the music for Bye Bye Birdie, Golden Boy, Applause, Annie, and now Annie Warbucks. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with composer Charles Strauss. You studied with Nadia Boulanger. Did she give you any advice about pop music versus classical music?
Well, oddly enough, she did. This woman was the great musician of our generation in many ways, and her greatness was that she was a master analyst, not only of music but a psychoanalyst in her own way. And she used to hear the music of her students, and she was able to isolate it. She was able to shine a spotlight on what was you, and what was watered down Stravinsky. I remember when I worked with her, she asked to hear everything I'd written, and I played her my sonata and my concerto and you know, various things, art songs and all that. And she said, well, what else? And I said, well, that's it. She said, well, no, what about, you know, your student pieces? And I played her some of them. And then she, anything else? And I said, well, I said, there was my parents, who were never into serious music at all, though they were very proud of me. I used to come home from college and play them all these pieces that sounded like watered down Bartok, really, but they were very serious kind of things. I was really, you know, into it. And I could see they were proud of me, but they didn't really
respond.
Yeah, not really. I mean, I think so. I mean, my mother was just always so nervous for me. But I remember writing a piece that I considered my party piece that I could play, that they could show off to my aunt. I had an aunt, Stella, who she was hard of hearing to begin with, but it was she was over at the house a lot. And I wrote this piece, and it was really, you know, I look back at it today, kind of saucy or something. It was very lighthearted. And they loved, everybody liked it. So it became my piece. I played that for her, which I very rarely, I didn't do that for anybody except, you know, a couple of relatives. And she said, ah, and she said, well, what else? And I said, well, I said, when my brother, he had been in the Navy, and when he came home from his first tour of duty or his boot camp, whatever, I had written a, I laugh because it was a funny moment in my life. And I said, I wrote this little song for him called Welcome Home, Able-Bodied Seaman Strauss. See? And she said, may I hear that? Oh, I said, I could. No, she said, please. And so there, this venerable woman, I played this silly song. She said, I see. She said, anything else? And I said, this makes me laugh. I said, I used to go out with a girl. I really liked her. Her name was Janet. And we lived on the Upper West Side of New York. And I wrote this song, but it was a joke called Moon Over 83rd Street. She said, play this for me. Here I am in Paris, you know, with an intimate of Stravinsky's and every American composer that you could think of having studied with this great woman. So I played Moon Over 83rd Street. And she said, ah, good. Now we go back to this, whatever. So we went back to... towards the end of my thing, she said to me something that nobody had ever said to me. She said, you have a great talent for light music.
May I make a request?
Sure.
Could you sing one of the songs that you played for her?
Wait a second. The Welcome Home, Mabel Bunny Seaman Strauss. You're right. No, I can't sing that one. Moon Over It. Oh, Moon. This is the funniest interview I've ever done. Moon Over 83rd Street with with shafts right below. Moon Over 83rd Street. My heart's all aglow. You, Janet, in the lamplight, I hear something call. I hear something dull. I'm yours, body and soul. I think that was the last one. It was meant partly as a jest. I mean, but that was it. There's a first performance for you.
So, but it helped you. It helped you find out that that's what you should be doing, is writing pop tunes.
That was her genius. That's why I can laugh at it. I can also laugh at it because I've had some successful shows. But her genius was really taking a young kid like me. I was quite young when I was there. I was around 18 or so, and I know from my own experience with my own children what it is to be searching for an identity. And she, in her soft, brilliant way, was able to contribute to my identifying who I was.
Mm-hmm. I want to close with the story behind one of your most famous songs, and this is the song from Annie, Tomorrow. Tell us about writing the song, what you intended when you wrote it, and the song has really taken on a life of its own. The song seems to alternate between major and minor keys, no?
Yes, it does. It's there are a number of feelings I have about the song. The first one always had been and still stays with me. I feel somebody you know, the a trooper is going to knock on my door and say, all right, come with us, you're under arrest, because it's the one song in the show, the one song of a personal nature in the show that could not have been written in the 30s. I could say the same perhaps for Hard Knock Life, but Hard Knock Life was a bit of dramatic music where I was kind of outside it in a way. But here's a song of a girl during the Depression, and this song is definitely could only been written in the 70s, the harmonies and the kind of melodic. So I thought, if nothing else, I mean, I didn't think the show was going to be successful, but I certainly felt as though critics were going to say, now, wait a second, how could they write this? Everything else was, we'd like to thank you, Herbert Hoover, and I don't need anything but you. I don't like the word pastiche because I filter it, I hope, through my own intelligence, but they were kind of pastiches using Harry Warren and Cole Porter and those kind of Gershwin composers as my the filter, so to speak. But that song, no, and it was just out of another era completely. So that was my first thing about it. The second thing about it was that nobody could sing it because it was so rangy.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing about it, which is, it's just curious. I've worked with a number of collaborators, though I've worked mostly with Lee Adams. But, you know, I've done a show with Sammy Kahn, with Alan J. Lerner, with Richard Maltby. I mean, there have just been a lot of them, Stephen Schwartz in my life, though not those particularly, but all the collaborators along the way, I had this song and I played it for many of them. And they all said, yeah, no, okay, what else do you have? Martin and I were looking for a song of hope at that moment. And I played him. Actually, it wasn't a whole song. I had written it for a movie, this theme for an industrial film that I did. And I always liked the theme. Martin picked up on it. And I had no idea. I certainly didn't think it was going to be a big success. I did think that it got an awfully big hand in the theater when Andrea sang it, but I thought it was the set. Martin had made a nice move with the set that had changed. She went behind, and then she wasn't there. So I always thought, gee, they're applauding. That's that set.
So this is a trunk song that every lyricist you work with rejected, and it finally went
on
point, to be a big success.
At that point, every lyricist, yeah.
All right. Well, let's hear it, and let me say it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Terry. For me, it's great.
Composer Charles Strauss, his latest musical, Annie Warbucks, is playing off Broadway. It's the sequel to Annie, and speaking of Annie, here's Tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The sun will come out tomorrow. Bet your bottom dollar that tomorrow there'll be sun. Just thinking about tomorrow clears away the cobwebs and the sorrow till there's none. When I'm stuck with a day that's gray and lonely, I just stick out my chin and grin and say, oh, the sun will come out tomorrow, so you gotta
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, an actor who's sometimes even funnier than the comic lines that are written for him. We talk with Nathan Lane, who's now starring in Neil Simon's new Broadway comedy, Laughter on the 23rd Floor. Before that, he was Nathan Detroit in the Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan reviews French Lessons, the new intellectual memoir by Alice Kaplan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. An Indian rebellion continues in southern Mexico, and at least 65 people have been killed. The insurgents say they're angry about poverty and abuse of Indians, and they've named themselves after Emiliano Zapata, who led peasant rebellions early this century. But State Department spokesman Michael McCurry says authorities don't really know who the insurgents are.
Been a variety of suggestions at this point about who might be accountable, who might be leading the insurgents. We are not in a position at this point to reach any conclusions.
McCurry says the State Department is sending a team to the area to see what's going on and to make sure Americans who remain there are safe.
We understand that all Americans who have wanted to leave that area have been able to do so recently, and we have had some direct contact with American citizens who indicate that they are safe despite the fighting in the vicinity.
The State Department has not issued an advisory against travel in the area. In Bosnia, artillery has been pounding Sarajevo today, killing 15 people. Residents of the capital city had been lured outdoors by good weather and by a brief lull in the bombardment. The French commander of UN forces says the Bosnian Serbs have been blocking his peacekeeping efforts by targeting UN forces and Bosnian civilians. He says the West should get tough with the Serbs, and he does not rule out asking for a NATO airstrike on Serbian artillery positions. Leaders of the former allies in the Bosnian War, the Muslims and Croats, may meet tomorrow to discuss disputes over territory and humanitarian efforts. Relations between those two factions have fallen apart, with the Croats often switching sides to fight with the Serbs. President Clinton held a White House meeting of top cabinet officials today to discuss strategy for getting his health care plan approved. The president predicts that Congress will pass a reform package this year. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Flanked by First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala, and Treasury Secretary Lloyd Benson, the president said he believes 1994 would be the year sweeping health care reform would become law. The president called on Americans to look at the alternatives and ask themselves which plan guarantees more choices. The president insists he's open to suggestions, but on one goal he will not compromise.
I have said all along what my bottom line is, that we have to have comprehensive benefits that can never be taken away.
With several alternative plans in the offing, the president concluded his remarks by saying he very much hopes health care reform will be a bipartisan effort. Carol Van Dam, the White House.
Stocks were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones average of 30 industrials was up 2.51 to close at 3756.60. Declines led advances by a margin of more than 4-3 in heavy trading of 269 million shares. This is NPR. President Clinton's top economic advisors say the American economy is improving steadily. Labor Secretary Robert Reich is predicting unemployment will drop 0.4 point to about 6%, and then about 2 million jobs will be created during 1994. Deputy Treasury Secretary Roger Altman says interest rates should not rise much, and the economy should grow by about 3%. Rescue workers in Canada are resuming their search for survivors from a cargo ship that sank off the coast of Newfoundland on Saturday. Officials are losing hope of finding anyone alive. John Halber reports.
Although initially Canadian search and rescue workers were confident they would find survivors, in the last few hours their optimism has all but vanished. The Marika 7, an iron ore bulk carrier, disappeared last Sunday halfway between Newfoundland and the British Isles. Rescue planes spotted two life rafts near the wreckage, but were unable to approach them due to the high waves, some more than 30 feet tall. But yesterday, when a Norwegian tanker finally managed to get near the rafts, no one could be found. The members of the crew, most of them Filipino or Greek, still have a chance to survive in spite of the cold, as the ship sank in the middle of the warm Gulf Stream. But high winds and a very cold surface temperature are making rescuers lose hope that anyone is still alive. For National Public Radio, this is John Hauber in Toronto.
The French government says it will ask Parliament to restrict the age at which women can use artificial methods to become pregnant. The health minister says it's dangerous and immoral for women past menopause to bear children using the latest controversial techniques. An Italian doctor has reported the birth of twins to a 59-year-old British woman who was impregnated with the fertilized eggs of a younger woman. Diplomats say four tourists on safari in Chad have been killed by a landmine. The diplomats say the explosion occurred along Chad's western border with Niger. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. One of the many pleasures of watching the Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls was Nathan Lane's great comedic performance as Nathan Detroit. He left the revival, but he's back on Broadway, starring in Neil Simon's new comedy, Laughter on the 23rd Floor. In movies, Lane played the gay next-door neighbor in Frankie and Johnny, co-starred with Michael J. Fox in Life with Mikey, and made a cameo appearance in Adam's Family Values. If you missed him in all of the above, perhaps you'd recognize him as the coughing, sneezing guy from an old NyQuil commercial. Before we meet him, let's hear some of his duet with Faith Prince from the cast recording of Guys and Dolls.
Serve a paper and sue me, sue me. What can you do me? I love you. Give a holler and hate me, hate me. Go ahead, hate me.
When
I love you.
When you wind up in jail, don't come to me to bail you.
All right, already. So call a policeman. All right, already. It's true. So new. So sue me, what can you do me? I love you.
You're at it again, you're running the game, I'm not gonna play.
Was being on Broadway and Guys and Dolls everything you'd hoped?
And more. was it everything I'd hoped? It really was. It was one of those times when everything sort of came together, and there were problems along the way, and I think it was interesting. We had a lot of time for rehearsal. We had about 7 weeks, and we didn't go out of town. And when you open in New York, you're really in a fishbowl here, and people, you know, don't wait. They like to go to the first preview and then get right home and call people and say, I hated it. And I think there was even more pressure. At first, we all thought, well, we're doing, you know, this classic musical. It's one of the best constructed and most beautifully written musicals in the world, and you know, but then you realize, well, all we can do is screw it up. So there is that sort of pressure, and everyone thinks they know how to do it, how it should be done.
Well, I knew how it should be done because of the summer camp production.
Right. Yeah. Everyone has done it. It's their favorite musical. So anyway, there was a lot of pressure, you know, people comparing it to the original, to the British production, or to their high school production. So
what would it take for you to cancel a performance if you weren't feeling well? How bad would you have to be feeling?
Cancel a performance? What kind of fascism is this?
Did you ever
There's
do it?
There's no such thing. Let's just forget you said that, Terry.
I mean, cancel you. I don't mean to cancel the whole show, but
what?
You know
for
what
me
I mean.
Not to go on.
For you not to go on.
Well, I couldn't. I would have to be, you know, have no speech whatsoever. If I had no voice at all, or I can remember in Merlin, Merlin, the magical musical for the entire family.
The short-lived magical musical.
No, it wasn't that short-lived.
It wasn't?
It was. I was there for 10 months, ooh, so that's not that short. At one point in a number, I stepped off a boat off stage and broke a bone in my foot. And I didn't have to go on for the rest of the first act, and so they took me to a dressing room, and they put ice on it, and they went and and bought a crutch at intermission, and I finished the show, the second act, on a crutch. And then I went to the emergency room afterwards, and they said, you're going to be in a cast for about 6 weeks. So I called the producers and on Monday and explained what had happened. And Merlin was a strange show. It was, these magic tricks surrounded by, musical numbers. It was Doug Henning and Cheetah Rivera. And I played Cheetah Rivera's son because of our striking physical resemblance. I'm often known as the Latin Spitfire of Broadway, Nathan Lane. And so I called them and said, I'm going to be in this thing for 6 weeks. Do you want to put the understudy on? Do you want to get someone else? And it was a show in which I had ad-libbed my way through most of it. I was kind of the comic relief in this thing. And so no one knew what the real lines were anyway. And so they said, no, we'd rather have you do it on crutches if you think you can do it. And so for 6 weeks, we were in previews for very long, longer than any show, I think, in history. When we opened, people thought it was a revival. Stop! You're killing me. So, and the show ran for 10 months, which just goes to prove that there's a lot of people in New Jersey. So I did the show for 6 weeks, and then I developed all this crutch business, And then when my leg got better, I sort of hated to give up the crutches because it was a great, I got a lot of sympathy from the audience.
So you're going to go on no matter what. This is your answer.
Oh, the great thing about the show is they made you sign a release, not to reveal how the tricks were done.
Yeah.
And
you're here to tell
us.
Isn't
this like the tags on your mattress? If you take them off, who's going to know? Are the police, the magic police, going to break in? Did you tell her there were two horses up against the wall? I've told everyone how the tricks were done. Two drinks, and yeah, I gave everything away, all the secrets. Well, Doug Henning has gotten out of magic now, He opened that transcendental theme park, Lazaland. Did you know that? Where you sit on a pillow and imagine you're on a roller coaster? Oh, baby, I'm cooking now. Oh.
You're killing.
I'm killing.
Oh, well, you're back on Broadway now in the new Neil Simon show.
And better than ever.
Better than ever. He's back and he's better than ever.
I'm sober. The blackouts have stopped. I'm ready to work.
So the show is based on what it was like behind the scenes when all these great writers like Neil Simon were writing for your show of shows, the Sid Caesar show. And you play the Sid Caesar guy.
Yes. In the play, he's called Max Prince.
Right.
But yes, it's inspired by Sid Caesar. And
so did the laughs come at the same spot every night, at the same places every night?
No, that's sort of the amazing and wonderful thing about the theater. It changes every night. And some nights it's raucous and it's amazing how, a large group of people just take on a personality. And there was last night there was a lady in the audience who was, she was giving birth. I don't know what she was doing. She was screaming. She was doing her own show. And, sometimes that's infectious and sometimes it just alienates 1,299 other people. And sometimes they think they're being helpful and they're not. And it's so weird because, someone can cough on a key word and then the moment is gone or the laugh is gone.
Can you recognize personality types now by the type of laugh that they have?
Personality types?
Uh-huh.
Well, there's the coughers laugh. There's the guys that go, ha! There's the people who want to know, let everyone know that they got the joke. Oh, that was good. Oh, good. Yeah, I'm from Bayonne. I don't know what I'm saying anymore. People are funny. You never know what's going to happen.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nathan Lane, and he's now starring on Broadway in Neil Simon's comedy, Laughter on the 23rd Floor. He also starred in the Broadway production, the revival that opened, a year or two ago, a year and a half ago, whatever, of Guys and Dolls. He was Nathan Detroit. We're going to be right back. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Back with actor Nathan Lane, who's now starring in Neil Simon's new Broadway comedy, Laughter on the 23rd Floor. Tell us something about your early years. Nathan Lane, the early years. You grew up in New Jersey. It's a good place to start. Tell us something about your family.
My family? Oh, my family is, look up dysfunctional in the dictionary. Their picture is there. They're all waving. Yeah. I come from, don't make me do this. Don't make me go there. Don't make me see the pain. Yeah, my family is, I have two older brothers. What can I tell you about them? I was born and raised in Jersey City.
What did your parents do for a living?
Poor but boring family. Uh-huh. What?
What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a truck driver. My mother was a secretary and a manic depressive. But really, manic depression took up most of her time.
Were you the wisecracking kid?
Was I the wisecracking kid? What do you think, Terry?
Oh, I think it's possible.
What do you think? Yes, I was the wisecracking kid. Yeah, well, what did Abe Lincoln say? If I didn't laugh, I'd cry. My childhood was tough. My father died when I was about 11. He was an alcoholic, and actually, my mother did go through manic depression for many years, but it made her a colorful character in the neighborhood. And then finally, she was put on lithium, that wonderful drug.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of a balances you out. I always thought if I took it, would I become an accountant and move to Ohio?
Did it help
It's
her?
A joke, Terry. Work with me. So, anyway, the family is very happy now. They're all fine now. And it was really my older brother, Dan, who got me interested in the theater. He's a teacher, and he would take his classes over to plays in New York, and he would take me with him, and that's how I got interested in the theater, and eventually I moved to New York and became a struggling, starving actor. You know, had all those strange jobs you have to do to
Such
make
as?
A living. Well, I used to deliver singing telegrams, Happy hysterectomy, happy hysterectomy. You know, it was like ridiculous. And people hate when you deliver singing telegrams. And I did this for a very long time. Congratulations, Shirley. Your stretch marks hardly show. And it was terrible.
Who wrote the songs?
They did. They would tell them whatever the occasion was, and they would put it, set it to a popular tune, one that was you didn't have to pay any royalties on. And then I used to sell TV Guide by phone. I used to do those surveys, the Harris Poll surveys. And what else? That was about it. I never waited on tables. So I just couldn't do that. I don't know why. I just thought of serving people. I don't know. I just couldn't do it.
I think your big break came when you started working with playwright Terrence McNally, who...
No, I was pretty successful before him.
Were you?
Sure, I was on Broadway with George C. Scott at Present Laughter.
Was that before that?
Oh, yeah. Oh. And I did a play with Simon Gregg called The Common Pursuit. And so I had a television series. I know, he likes to think he took me out of the gutter. But no, I'd done a couple of things before I met him. But yes, thank God I did, because... It certainly really did turn things around for me when we did a play of his called The Lisbon Traviata.
You've been in your share of flops, too.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. How does it feel to be in a flop? Do you get really, really depressed and insecure?
No, you feel great.
You feel great.
Because, there's nothing like living on the edge, knowing you're going down for the count. Yes, of course you're depressed. It's a flop. That's the big difference. If you're in a hit, you feel good. Flop, bad. Hits, good. Yes, that's what happens. You're depressed. But there's something, it's like being on the Titanic. There's nothing like the camaraderie of people in a flop, believe me. And I've certainly had my share.
Could you see it coming? The shows at flop?
Oh, sure. Sometimes the first day of rehearsal, you just look across the room and it all spells doom. It rhymed. Hey, I'm one of the poets you're interviewing. it's, yeah, you get it. There's something, I just saw this really strange movie the other night. I rented this movie because a woman in the video store recommended it. A total stranger said, have you seen Jennifer 8? And I said, no. And she said, oh, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And I rented it. And it was, you know, a bizarre movie. And this was sort of like a pretentious thriller. But one of my favorite line in the movie was one of the cops is talking about someone they're investigating. And he says, I don't know. I sniff grief. I sniff grief, he said. So that's what happens when you're in a flop.
Right.
Next time I'm in one, I'm going to say, hey, I sniff grief.
So are you still preparing to do a revival of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum? I read that that was in the works.
Yes.
So will you get to sing comedy tonight?
I will. I'll be the one who comes out and sings that.
That should be fun.
It should. It's a great show. It's funny, not a lot of people know the show that well. They know the movie, which was very weird because it sort of, they kind of ruined it in a way. They made it very realistic, and so you actually saw, you know, horse poop in the streets, people sweating in ancient Rome, and it was ugh. But it wasn't pleasant. When they talk about mayor's sweat, they actually saw a cup of it. You don't want to see these things. But the play itself is, it's certainly the funniest book ever written for a musical, and I think Mr. Sondheim is going to write a couple of new songs.
Wow.
It should be very exciting. Jerry Zaks, who directed Guys and Dolls, is going to direct it.
He directed the Neil Simon show, too,
yes,
didn't
he did.
Right.
We're inseparable now.
Yeah.
We're all getting aloft.
Well, Nathan Lane, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And hey, lighten up, you know?
Okay.
Nathan Lane is starring in Neil Simon's new Broadway comedy, Laughter on the 23rd Floor, and you can hear him as Nathan Detroit on the cast recording of Guys and Dolls. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Elizabeth Arnold reports tonight the Justice Department will proceed as usual to investigate possible wrongdoings in a savings and loan owned by a friend of President Clinton. Republicans, as you know, have been asking for an independent counsel. I'll talk with a reporter in Tunis about Yasser Arafat's troubles within the PLO. A delegation has come to Tunis to complain about the Arafat leadership. Dan Charles has a report on privacy issues in this country. Information brokers are setting up to sell data about people collected by computers. And Susan Stamberg talks with conductor Andre Previn about his jazz piano career.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you're in the mood for one of those traditional American autobiographies where somebody survives a dysfunctional childhood and grows up to become a millionaire celebrity, critic Maureen Corrigan says stick with Howard Stern. But if the new year has put you in a more contemplative frame of mind, she recommends Alice Kaplan's new memoir, French Lessons. It's about how Kaplan, a middle-class Midwestern Jewish girl, found her voice in a foreign language.
If, like me, you feel your command of French culture doesn't extend much beyond Chanel No. 5 and Jerry Lewis, Alice Kaplan's new memoir, French Lessons, might just turn you into a fervent Francophile. In this intellectual memoir, Kaplan recounts how she fell in love with the French language, spent years studying French literature and history, and eventually became a French professor herself. She also explores her general fascination with words and their power to both distort and excavate the truth. Kaplan's strange story of how she discovered her truest self in a foreign language translates well. Kaplan's memoir opens with a tragedy. One evening, when she was only 7, she and her father were out fishing. He had a sudden heart attack and died. Kaplan's father had been a larger-than-life figure to her. He had been a prosecutor at the Nuremberg war crimes trials. In the aftermath of his death, Kaplan turned into an apathetic adolescent, so her mother decides to send her to a Swiss boarding school. It's there she passionately immerses herself in French and learns to roll her R's with guttural abandon, like Eartha Kitt. Reflecting on why French took such a powerful hold of her, Kaplan confesses that people want to adopt another culture because there's something in their own they don't like, something that doesn't name them. French, she says, released her from her Midwestern complacency, gave her permission to be ambitious, and taught her the words for parts of her body she could finally claim. The whole drama of becoming a thinking woman, Kaplan says, was set into motion when she first mastered that deep French R. As she goes on to describe her college teaching career, Kaplan offers lots of insights about the value and the violence inherent in making students speak in a foreign language. But the most compelling parts of this memoir are where Kaplan describes the painful lessons she learned from two of her most enigmatic encounters. The first was with Paul DeMond, who taught at Yale when Kaplan was a graduate student there. The father of American deconstruction, DeMond insisted that literature be stripped of its historical, biographical, and political contexts. Kaplan paints an alternately comical and creepy picture of how she and other DeMond disciples would sit in baffled adoration at the great professor's lectures. When years after his death, it was discovered that DeMond had written for pro-Nazi newspapers during World War II, Kaplan recognizes that she and her fellow Yalies had been duped by DeMond's dazzling language. Around that same time, Kaplan interviews an elderly Frenchman who had written pro-fascist articles during the war. Throughout the three-day interview, Kaplan never mentions her own Jewishness, believing she should maintain an academic pose of objectivity. Later, she receives a letter from the avuncular fascist that's filled with anti-Semitic diatribe. Kaplan flashes on an old photo she has of her father with headphones on at the Nuremberg trials. She thinks about the lessons he could have taught her about the dangers of regarding literature, ideas, and other people as though they could ever be apolitically pure. French Lessons is an engaging and at times chilling memoir about the tough process of learning to think for yourself. If you doubt that thinking can be an exhilarating form of action, French Lessons could change your mind.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed French Lessons by Alice Kaplan. We welcome the listeners of three stations which have just started broadcasting Fresh Air, KERA in Dallas, WITF in central Pennsylvania, and WAMC Albany, Northeast Public Radio. And welcome back to Fresh Air senior producer Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Bob Balls, Audrey Vablaitis, and Richard Parker. Roberta Shurruck directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.